Support by Denali National Park. Enjoy the views along the way and keep your eyes open for moose, bears, caribou, and 130 different bird species in the park's natural wilderness area. Exploring your home state is the COVID-safe way to enjoy the summer.
Welcome to Native America Calling. From Albuquerque, I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Mountains, hills, canyons, forests, and rivers are among Native sacred areas, ceremonial grounds, traditional homelands, and places of origin. But Western systems of land ownership often prevent tribes from legally controlling what happens on those lands. Coming up, we'll talk about a recent news series looking into barriers to protect sacred places in the Southwest. Join us after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Chip Krause, in for Antonia Gonzalez. On Tuesday, Minnesota Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal by opponents of the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline. In a one-page order, the state's highest court affirmed a decision in June by the Minnesota Court of Appeals to allow construction on the project to proceed. On Wednesday, hundreds gathered outside the Minnesota State Capitol to protest the Line 3 pipeline project. Activist group Roots Action posted a series of videos via Twitter. Work is finished on parts of the Enbridge pipeline that run through portions of Canada, North Dakota, and Wisconsin. Activist Winona LaDuke addressed a crowd captured in this livestream audio from Honor the Earth.
Unlike a lot of the other water protectors here facing charges in three counties, I'm not a criminal. I'm a water protector. The criminal is Enbridge.
The portion that runs through Minnesota is about 90% complete. Cannabis industry website Leafly is reporting that the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation and the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians anticipate opening mega dispensaries next year. Connecticut legalized marijuana on July 1st, with licensed retail stores expected to open next summer. And the Mashantucket Pequot plan to open a marijuana store near Foxwoods Resort Casino in Eastern Connecticut. In North Carolina, recreational and medical marijuana are illegal. The Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians plans to open a cannabis store on tribal land. One location option would be near Harris Cherokee Casino Resort. Earlier this month, the tribe voted to legalize medical marijuana on tribal land. According to the tribe's governmental affairs liaison, it would likely be the only legal cannabis dispensary within hundreds of miles. And the Compassionate Care Act, which seeks to legalize medical marijuana, continues to move through the state legislature. Dillingham, Alaska's utility co-op is one of 18 utility companies around the country to receive a USDA grant to boost internet and broadband service around the country. KDLG's Tyler Thompson has more.
Nishigaag Cooperative is set to bring unlimited internet to all service areas by 2023 with help from a $16.7 million federal grant. Those communities include Aleknagik, Clark's Point, Dillingham, Eacock, Manicotic, and Portage Creek. Right now, residents in the area can only get a maximum of 300 gigabytes of bandwidth at around $180 per month. The new unlimited plans will come at no extra cost to residents. The internet will also be 10 times faster than its current speeds. CEO Bob Hemschut said the upgrade is a game changer.
The sort of capacity that can be provided by fiber connection is a complete different level from even the microwave. The microwave was an increased service level to our communities, but it is still bandwidth limited. Fiber is a permanent transport that is scalable for future needs.
The proposed route to install the fiber cable would run from the co-op's microwave antenna site in Leavelock to Eckwalk, then Aleknagik to Dillingham. Those cables will also be routed from the cable plant to homes in Dillingham and Aleknagik. Nishigaag Cooperative estimates that the project will cost $24 million. The co-op will use money from the USDA grant and $6.5 million in term loan money from the National Rural Utilities Cooperative Finance Corporation, or CFC. The co-op will front the remaining $784,000 in capital assets. Reporting for KDLG in Dillingham, I'm Tyler Thompson.
The Ute Mountain Ute Tribe opened a charter school to 23 kindergarten and first grade students. The charter school building isn't finished, but officials hope to complete the work in late September. The school will embrace Ute language and culture along with learning within the fields of science, technology, engineering, and math. The school is also open to students in the area regardless of tribal affiliation, and it hopes to expand to include 2nd through 4th grade learning next year. For National Native News, I'm Trip Krause.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by BNSF Railway, proudly supporting the nation's economy by moving the goods that feed, supply, and power communities across the country. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations. Support by the Sanosky Chambers Law Firm, championing tribal sovereignty and defending Native American rights since 1976, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Oak Flat, the San Francisco Peaks, and others are sacred places for tribes in Arizona. They're for ceremony, resting places of ancestors, and origin. But accessing these areas by Native people includes challenges by federal and state. There's also tribes have to fight wealthy companies and governments to protect them. This hour, we'll hear about a series by the Arizona Republic, which takes an in-depth look at how tribes navigate barriers to protect sacred sites. We also want to hear from you. What areas are sacred to you that you want protected? Does your tribe have control? Give us a call. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we have a lineup of guests joining us this hour. Deb Kroll is the Indigenous Affairs Reporter at the Arizona Republic. Dr. David Martinez, an Associate Professor in American Indian Studies at Arizona State University. Robert Miller, a professor at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. Thank you so much for joining us today. Deb, why don't you go ahead and kick us off this hour and tell us about your series.
Well, the series centers around the efforts of Native peoples, primarily here in the Southwest, how they're able to protect, or the barriers that they're encountering, protecting sacred and culturally significant sites that aren't within their tribal land boundaries. And our research, of course, indicates that a good number of them, if not most of them, are not on a reservation. And a really strong number of them are on public lands. So in order for tribes to be able to keep these sites from being desecrated, from turning into a big giant sinkhole, from being vandalized, they are forced to work with mostly federal agencies. So we wanted to see how well they're doing, how well the laws are working, how well the laws may not be working, and to see what could be happening in the future.
You've been covering Indigenous issues for a while, long time now. And why choose this particular topic and series to take a look at?
Well, when I was a girl, you know, growing up in my ancestral homeland on California's Central Coast, we're a landless tribe, so none of our sites are really under our control. And one site in particular that a lot of people in California know about is a place called Morro Rock, but we call it Lasamo. It's one of our most sacred places. And before Europeans showed up on the scene, Indian people from all over would come to pray at Lasamo. It's a place of power. It's a place of great sacredness. Yet we had very little and sometimes no input on what happened to that place. It's a California State Monument, a California State Beach, and most of the time the answer was, you could be like a stakeholder, but we don't have to listen to you. So that's always kind of intrigued me. How do these things work? You know, why has there seemed to be some sort of resistance by federal agencies, state agencies, and other people like private industries to not want to protect these sites? So we started working on it, and this is where we're at today.
And I mentioned just a couple of the sites that you had covered in the series. Was there any particular one that, you know, just really grabbed your attention and you hope to keep covering and continuing on and looking at it?
Well, I've been covering the Oak Flat issue off and on now for about 5 or 6 years, starting when I was a freelancer with Indian Country Today, continuing on with the Arizona Republic. Looking into the past, the Apache people and the Chiricahua Band in particular have been greatly impacted by governmental decisions. The treaty between the Apache tribe of Apache Nation of Indians and the U.S. government in 1852 did not directly lead to reservations being established. Those came about because President Grant went ahead and issued an executive order. But when he issued the executive order, he didn't specifically say pursuant to the treaty of. And so that kind of opened, I'll let the lawyers here talk about this, but just looking at that, it seems to have resulted in the Apache tribes, various Apache tribes here in Arizona, losing about 75% of the original reservation that had been set aside for them. Unfortunately, Oak Flat was not one of those places. And so the Apache people and some of the other tribes in the area who also hold Oak Flat in cultural significance had a series of successes and failures in protecting it. Oak Flat in particular, it's one of Arizona's few remaining riparian zones. It's a site where there are several altars and there's sweat lodge sites. It's also a popular rock climbing area, and it's a place where Wenzler Nosy and other Apache people call another home of the Gon, the mountain spirits. They also live in the deeps and springs of the Mount Graham, and they somehow or another, back in the Eisenhower era, the government had placed that area of Oak Flat under what they call a mineral withdrawal, which is you cannot mine for anything in this area because of its significance. But in 2014, what everybody calls a literal midnight rider, a group of congressmen here in Arizona managed to get a last minute rider stuck onto a National Defense Authorization bill. And we call these the no fail bills because they're basically funding defense operations. And because of that last minute rider, it authorized the swap of about 2,400 acres of Oak Flat to Resolution Copper Company, which is owned by foreign mining interests, primarily in Australia, Great Britain, and Canada. And in return, Resolution was going to give the Forest Service 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 acres of other environmentally significant lands. And of course, the purpose of this was to be able to mine for one of the U.S.'s biggest remaining sources of copper ore. Now, we have to understand that copper has been mined in around Oak Flat, Superior, and going east all the way to Globe for more than 100 years. And there were some existing mine shafts that go underneath Oak Flat, but they didn't really impact upon the riparian zone. It didn't directly impact upon anybody's ability to use that land for sacred purposes, ceremonial purposes, gathering medicinal plants, gathering acorns in the fall and winter. But how Resolution wants to mine it would basically obliterate Oak Flat, because the way that they're going to do it is basically tunnel underneath the ore body and then successively collapsing the ground above onto, upon itself, so that they can take that ore body and truck it out through a underground pipeline to a crushing facility. And Resolution has on their website, and they have YouTube videos, exactly what's going to happen, which is by the time they're done, Oak Flat will be a sinkhole somewhere between 8 and 1,000 feet deep and almost 2 miles wide in diameter. Now, not only the tribes, but independent hydrologists are greatly concerned. First of all, for the religious and ceremonial purposes, Oak Flat will be gone forever. And also for the water aspect, there's a lot of underground water under there, in both with aquifers and basically underground rivers that feed a lot of the water supply for the eastern part of the Phoenix metro area. So there's a lot of concern that water will either be contaminated or the flow will be disrupted, which will disrupt flows into an area known as Queen Creek and eventually to the Gila River. So there's been a lot of consternation and protest and awareness raising ever since this happened. And the land swap almost went through. Five days before Joe Biden took office, the Forest Service issued what they called the Final Environmental Impact Report, which set into motion a 60-day window upon which the Forest Service, by the law that was passed, would have to hand that land over to Resolution. However, the Joe Biden administration put a halt to that temporarily and sent the environmental impact report back to the Forest Service to do deeper consultation with tribes. In the meantime, Apache Stronghold, which is a group that Wenzler Nosey, who, by the way, is also the former chairman of the San Carlos Apache Tribe, a nonprofit that he and other Apache people formed to advocate for Oak Flat, has filed suit in federal court to stop it under First Amendment religious freedom issues.
Hold that thought, Deb. We got to take a short break. We're talking about sacred spaces, sacred lands, and we have a lineup of guests. We have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Prenatal nutrition can be a challenge for many Indigenous women. Some pregnant mothers and their supporters are turning to traditional food systems to create a diet that is nourishing and healing. We're talking about prenatal nutrition in Native America on the next Native America Calling.
As COVID-19 vaccines are becoming available, Americans are eager to learn more, but frustrated about where to find answers. That's why AARP is working to protect Americans 50+ by connecting you to the latest information. You can learn who's eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine in your state, when, where, and how to get it, and what you might want to discuss with your doctor at aarp.org/vaccineinfo. AARP supports this program.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. We're talking about protecting sacred places today. We want to hear from you. Our phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We have a great lineup of guests joining us today to talk about this. And Deb, I just wanted to give you a quick minute to just wrap up your thought of, you were talking about Oak Flat and just giving us a little background and, looking at court cases and now what's happening.
So in October, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals will hear Apache Stronghold's appeal to this. And in the meantime, Beckett Law, which is a nonprofit religious liberty law institute and law firm, has come in and has taken Apache Stronghold's case. So it's going to be one of the big law issues, I should say, cases to watch this year. So we're going to be there. We're going to see what happens. And in the meantime, there's a bill floating through Congress. If it's passed through both houses and signed by Joe Biden, we'll reverse the land swap. So that's where we're at with Oak Flat.
Thanks for that, Deb. And definitely going to be watching Oak Flat. Been covering that here on Native America Calling in the news for years. And I want to welcome back our other guests as well, Dr. David Martinez, Robert Miller, and also Lieutenant Governor of Zuni Pueblo, Carlton Bawakati. Welcome to Native America Calling. Lieutenant Governor, can you share why sacred site protection is so important to Zuni Pueblo and just the tribes in the Southwest? Welcome.
Thank you. How are you today? Thank you for having me, and I'd like to speak to a couple different areas as to why sacred sites are important to the Zuni Pueblo. When we look at reservation lines and state boundaries and county jurisdictions that have come over time, we've seen more and more of our ancestral ties to traditional cultural properties, certain places that we name in our prayers and our songs still exist, and we make those connections in different ways. And as a Zuni person, as a Zuni tribal leader, I can speak to those, but I can't effectuate some of those relationships with the from person to place. And what I mean by that is there's certain esoteric realms that exist within our community that require dedication, and there's only certain people that are privy to these certain information, and the ability for them to be able to carry out their duties is why I believe our tribal government exists, so that way our people can continue to effectuate a way of life that has existed over thousands of years. Throughout this process, not only as a tribal leader, but now as a member of medicine society, I'm beginning to understand more and more why that personal connection is important. When we look at the longevity of why we were created, when we look at our creation and migration story, which tells us that we emerged from the Grand Canyon out into this fourth world to our destiny. And when we had to effectuate that destiny, we spread out throughout the Southwest, and we traveled, and we knew other people, and some of those songs and prayers that we share with them, we continue to continue that way of life here in Zuni. And for our society, we have certain songs and prayers that really are only ours. And then other societies, whether it's the Rain Priest Society, Medicine Societies, the Kiva Societies, they all have their connections to that place and time. And really what our intention is to make sure that we continue to effectuate that. One of the things that we, if you look at the Arizona side and the Zuni Pueblo, one of the things, if you Google Zuni heavens, you'll see the long history that we have of trying to effectuate a pilgrimage that, again, has gone on for thousands of years. And now with state boundaries and private jurisdictions, private lands, we've often been at odds with those different landowners to try to get to the places that we need to get to. When our practitioners make that pilgrimage, there are certain places that they have to get to and certain prayers and songs that each society has to do on their own, in their own way and time. And for those to be in the modern way of life, discontinued or affected, it does cause spiritual harm to a lot of our people. And when we look at the longevity of our way of life, our prayers aren't just for the Zuni people, it's for Mother Earth and all its peopling. So that's a small glimpse of why our work is important, and not only on the Arizona and the Zuni, on the Mexico side, but throughout the Southwest in general. So that's a small glimpse of our ancestral footprint and the responsibilities that we have in trying to make sure that we speak to our ancestors in those situations. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Lieutenant Governor. And David, the Lieutenant Governor had mentioned, you know, in the fight, whether it's a legal battle or in other battles to protect these sacred areas, you know, there's a lot of cultural knowledge that is sacred to tribes. But, you know, when you're in court setting or even just in a public setting, people are always asking why. And when you look at that issue, you know, news stories, programs like this help educate the public. So what is, you know, tie that back to cultural misunderstandings. Go ahead, David.
Well, when it comes to talking about sacred places within the American political and legal framework environment, you have to understand that when it comes to indigenous spirituality and mainstream, usually Christian spirituality, you're talking about two very different types of religious culture, spiritual culture. And so Americans are accustomed to thinking about religion, you know, in terms of worshiping in a church, you know, having a sacred book like the Bible, you know, or the Quran or the Talmud. You think of Americans will think of religion as being maintained by a professional class called priests. And that's very different for indigenous people, wherever you find indigenous people. Which are going to be land-based cultures, and their sense of spirituality is going to be connected to their sacred geography. And so whenever these issues come up, you know, in the public forum, you know, in court, it's always incumbent upon, the onus is always on indigenous people to explain why their spiritual traditions are valid, even though they do not meet the paradigm of the Western definition of church and religion. And so when you talk about sacred places, you know, you're talking about something that doesn't really have a counterpart in, say, the Christian tradition. And so when you try to explain, you know, why a given place is so important to you, part of the explanation has to include educating, you know, your white audience, your non-Indian audience, about how your relationship to that place, you know, is different from, say, an American's relationship to that same place. They're going to think of it, American will think of it in terms of, you know, property, real estate, you know, public lands. They're not going to think about that place as being a living being, you know, that embodies or is home to a spirit that is a part of your creation story. And because you believe, you know, that that place is a living being that is home to sacred beings, to spirits, you know, you can understand that your relationship as an indigenous person, your relationship to that place is a kinship relationship. Same as the kinship you have with your own family and community. And because it's a kinship relationship with that place, it means that you don't have a legal relationship to that mountain or that river. You have an ethical relationship. Just as you have an ethical relationship, you know, to your relatives, which means that you have responsibilities to that place. So one of the things that frustrates a lot of indigenous people when they're trying to protect these places within the American justice system is this idea, this opinion that our sacred places, you know, are not within our control, that are not within our boundaries. They're not within the reservation boundaries, but they are definitely still a part of our ancestral boundaries. Regardless of what the white man's law says about the land, the territory, it's like this. You know, your mother is always your mother, no matter where she is, whether she's in the home with you or whether she's far away. You know, but maybe because of some calamity, you know, your mother's been taken from you. She's been forcibly removed from your life, but she's still your mother, no matter what. And I think at an emotional level, you can get non-Indians to understand that. But at a legal level, the Metagons, the whites, they don't know how to include that into their laws. That's why there's no laws protecting sacred places.
And thank you for that, David. And Robert, to add to what David is talking about, is that why it's so important to bring Indian law, bring tribal knowledge into the classroom when you're teaching? Go ahead, Robert.
Thank you. Yes, I agree with what David said, absolutely. I tell my classes the only cases that tribal peoples, ourselves, ever win is when we can convince the judges there's some analogy to Christian values. There's a famous case about moose meat in the Alaska Supreme Court, I think clear back in 1961, and the court saw and could understand the value of moose meat for funeral ceremonies and said it was like the sacrament at a Christian church. The few prisoner cases that have ever won the rights to keep like medicine bags, even though you're an inmate in prison, is when they were able to convince the court that it was like a Christian wearing a cross around their neck. So what David said is absolutely correct. If we can get people to understand the analogy, or at least to understand the value of other cultural beliefs, diversity. So what you just asked me, yes, the idea of teaching American students the full history of America and the full history of law. I will propose something that maybe disagrees a little bit with what David said, but I think American culture might see a couple of sacred sites, putting quotes around the word sacred. Do you think the city of Salt Lake would condemn the Mormon Tabernacle and build a highway through there? Would we condemn Gettysburg and build a high-rise at Gettysburg Battlefield? Would we tear down the National Cathedral in D.C. to build a skyscraper? So Americans, if we could just make the analogy to a few of the parts that are like sacred, putting quotes around that, to Americans, maybe we could help to defend our sacred sites. But as already been mentioned, under Anglo-American property law, if you don't own the real estate, it's pretty hard to tell someone else what to do with it. So we are in a difficult situation.
Thank you for that, Robert. And we want to hear from our listeners. What do you think? Are there areas that are sacred to you that your tribes have control of or don't have control of? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's go to Melvin listening to us in Santee, Nebraska on KZYK. Hello.
Hey, good morning. I'd like to continue on what he was saying about having these college professors telling us what's sacred. The tribes have to contribute in this process and let us tell you, the commission, what is sacred instead of the maybe one of the bogus Clovis things. You know, there's so many studies being done. We're well-studied people. We never see the results of the study. We never get to know any of that information. But it's very important that we get the history and the knowledge of the people's past lives into the circle. We're not educating our children on this because some tribal councils have rules that you only can speak Dakota or Lakota or Dakota or whatever in the 1868 you have to speak. Well, about 90% of those listeners, I mean, people that covered under the treaty aren't getting to understand. I think they need to change that to work getting that done to educating our people on what their rights are.
Thank you so much, Melvin, for calling in and sharing your thoughts. We want to hear from our audience. What do you think? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And Robert, go ahead and just respond to the caller.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm the right person to respond to him, but let me make one more point as a legal attorney, as a law professor, excuse me, and this addresses what Deb Kroll has mentioned about this case coming up in the Ninth Circuit. The Supreme Court decided a case in 1988, called Ling versus Northwest Indian Cemetery Protective Association in Northern California about sites that were sacred to tribal peoples and the three tribes that are located up there. And the fact that the Forest Service wanted to cut the trees and then wanted to build a highway, and the tribes resisted because that this was a power area where their medicine people went to get spiritual strength, to go on vision quests, whatever you want to call it. And we lost that case. Sandra Day O'Connor writes the opinion. She says that there was no violation of the First Amendment. There was no violation of the right to the free exercise of religion. And she did not even get into the standard test when we look at the violation of constitutional rights. Government is supposed to be serving a compelling state interest by the least restrictive means if it infringes on you or my constitutional rights. But the Ling decision did not even reach that test because they said that building a highway or cutting down all these trees did not coerce these native peoples into violating their religion. So if this Ninth Circuit case that Ms. Kroll has mentioned about Oak Flat is going to be faced squarely by that precedent, they're going to be faced by the precedent of the Ninth Circuit that refused to protect Snow Bowl here in Arizona, where the snow ski place was allowed to make snow out of recycled water and cover all sorts of sacred sites and shrines for Hopi, Navajo, and other tribes. So in the court system, we have some very bad precedent that makes it nearly impossible for tribal peoples to enforce their rights on federally owned land. I will
thank you for
quickly.
That, Robert. So, yep, sorry about that. We got to take a short break. I'll let you wrap up your thought. You're listening to Native America Calling. We're talking about sacred land protection. Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. We'll be right back.
Support by Amerind, Indian Country's 100% tribally owned insurance partner. Amerind works with tribal governments and their business enterprises to provide effective commercial insurance coverage, strengthen Native American communities, protect tribal sovereignty, and help keep dollars in Indian Country. More information on property, liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto solutions at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Thank you for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. We're talking about sacred site protection today. We got a full lineup of guests, but we also want to hear from you. What do you think? You're tuning in to this conversation today. There's still time to get in. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And Robert, just wanted to give you a chance to wrap up your thought. Thank you.
Yes, there are three federal laws that give tribal Indian nations input on the operations on federal lands. The Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act applies on federal and tribal lands. The Archaeological Resource Protection Act applies on federal and tribal lands. And the National Historic Preservation Act allows tribes to participate and consult and even to have tribal sacred sites listed on the National Register of Historic Places, which gives them some procedural protection. President Clinton issued an executive order in 1996 granting tribes the right to consult with federal agencies before decisions are made about sacred sites, and Congress has put this obligation of consultation into many different statutes, and a few federal agencies have put it into their regulations. But the right to consult isn't the right to make an ultimate decision. So we consult, we lobby, we argue. That doesn't mean we'll be happy with the final result.
All right. Thank you for that, Robert. And we got another caller. Let's go to Shell in Pocatello, Idaho, listening to us on KISU. Hello.
Appreciate you. I'm almost Antonia. Good morning, Antonia.
Good morning.
You know, I'm calling from southeastern Idaho, you know, along, you know, I-86, you know, all along the south interstate going west toward Oregon. And all along through there, there's sacred sites and mounds and rock petroglyphs on boulders and all that, but they have circular form buildings that are thousands of years old. But what's happening within the past 60 years is they've been bulldozing them and making it look like there's, you know, nothing was really there in the beginning. And so, like, people, like the public, wouldn't even know that they existed at all. And that went on and it's going on, and a lot of places have disappeared. And since I, you know, when I was a kid, I used to see the boulders that had petroglyphs on them and at the rest areas, and they don't exist anymore, you know. And that's all along southeastern Idaho, all the way to the Oregon border.
Well, thank you for that and for calling us and tuning in today. Let's go to another caller, Regina on Pine Ridge Reservation, South Dakota, listening to us on Keeley Radio. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me. I want to talk about a tree or 374 trees that were ratified by Congress. Now, we live on reservations. That's what we call originally the concentration camps. And we've been prisoners of war for 145 years now. We didn't give up on them. They took it from us by massacring our people and rounding us up like a bunch of slaves. They couldn't round us up as slaves, but they couldn't kill us off. So they put us on in concentration camps. That way they take the rest of the land. I think it's time, I believe it's time that we look at the treaties and take a treaty stand and remember that those reservations are only prison of war camps. The land still belongs to the indigenous people. And I just wanted to make that clear. And also to look at the U.S. Constitution and read Article 6. Section 2, read it all. Anybody who ever raised their hand on to take an oath is supposed to honor that treaty. And I think one of the biggest things we could say is tell them, go home. That was an original census this year that people, the one that came up first, it said something about the origin of your country. And I think it was geared to the Mexicans, but it was given out to a lot of people.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for calling in and tuning in to Native America Calling today. Lieutenant Governor, I wanted to have you just, we're talking about a lot of legal challenges and a caller brought up the treaties. What do you think, or how is different administrations playing into sacred site protection? Is the current administration going to play into that? Go ahead, Lieutenant Governor.
Thank you, and I appreciate the comments earlier from Dr. Martinez and Judge Miller. But as far as the most recent visits I've been able to encounter have been not only with Assistant Secretary Brian Newland at the Chaco Canyon Heritage Park, but also at Bears Ears with Secretary Deb Holland. And what was mentioned earlier was, how do we reinforce treaties? How do we reinforce the underlying assumptions of trying to get the government to understand what the struggles of Native Americans face on a daily basis? You know, as tribal leaders, we have a ton of priorities, but one of the things that I can point to is that it was really, a breath of fresh air that I didn't have to relate to Deb Holland, Secretary Holland, that what our Pueblo values are. She knows it. She's a mother. She's a Pueblo woman. She knows these things inherently, and I can speak to those without having to, try to get some non-native to understand. And the same thing with now confirmed Assistant Secretary Mr. Newland. You know, being able to speak with him and know that he was at one point a tribal leader facing the same issues that I face, regulatory-wise, protection of sacred sites, preservation of our native tongues. We understand those things, and it was a breath of fresh air not have to recount that fight, but to know they understood inherently what your struggles are and they will be willing to assist you. And so in that process, what we've also done as a tribe has been interpret federal regulations. What was mentioned was Section 106, and through the Section 106 process, we have expanded what we believe is a definition of tribal consultation and what is effective collaborative management. So those are some of the things that we continue to utilize, not only through legal advocates and through attorneys, but through really sticking to our values that our ancestors expect of us and trying to navigate that through this complex world. But it's nothing new to them, and we just have to rely on the strength of their resiliency to move forward. So those are, I guess, a couple examples of where we can not only effectively nominate and push people such as Congresswoman Holland, now Secretary Holland, into positions that Native Americans can continue to advocate in those avenues and venues. So that's, I guess, one example I can speak to where we're trying to change the dynamics of how we interact with our government by maybe having some of those elected officials that inherently know these things. So thank you.
Thank you for that, Lieutenant Governor. And David, just to add or expand on what the Lieutenant Governor is talking about, you know, we're talking about educating, and also, you know, we talk a lot on this program about representation, and Native representation matters. But, you know, for the public reading this series that we're talking about today, what do you hope that they get out of it? Go ahead, David.
Well, I hope that when it comes to Indigenous people's relationship to the United States of America, which is based on this founding document that they call the U.S. Constitution, I hope that people, you know, think about rights in terms of communities, not just individual rights. America is built on this mythology that it's the land of opportunity. Opportunity means you know, economic opportunity to be able to raise yourself up by your own bootstraps, you know, until you reach, you know, the highest level of affluence that's possible in this country. But, you know, what about, communities? What about communities' relationship to their land? You know, American democracy really doesn't have a way of understanding the rights of communities. You know, and particularly the rights of tribes. You know, it thinks about rights as individual rights, you know, in which case you're only responsible, you're only accountable to yourself and no one else. But we need to think about rights in terms of the communal and how communities need a healthy relationship to their environment in order to thrive. And so how do you think about the powers and privileges available through the Constitution that support that? You know, if you can't think about the relationship between land and people when you talk about the Constitution, then I don't see how you can talk about adequately and effectively preserving and protecting, you know, these fundamental relationships. So, you know, think about others. Think about the land. You know, when you think about rights, and think about how Indigenous peoples are an integral part of this land. And if, when you think about the United States, I hope you think about Indigenous people first. That's what I hope, because it gets a little tiring having to remind people that we're still here. You know, we're still beholden to our ancestors, you know, and that we still have a relationship to our homelands. This is like this never-ending battle to get heard. I hope that we can reach a point where, instead of struggling to be heard, that Americans, for a change, think of us first and foremost when these issues about the environment or sacred places come up.
Thank you for that, David. And Deb, to add or expand to what David said, what do you hope readers got out of your series, and maybe even what was some of the response you can share?
Well, I'm hoping that readers gain a better understanding of why certain places are sacred to Native peoples, why why they, you know, why they need to be protected, what some of the issues are that are impeding tribes' ability to protect them, and perhaps to maybe come up with some solutions. You know, somebody might be influenced to start coming up with some solutions to better protect these sites, and as Bob Miller said, to better protect tribes' First Amendment rights to protect religion. And the response has been overwhelmingly positive. I've had a lot of great feedback from people. And of course, there's always the naysayers in the group, you know, the people who there was one reader who said, well, if it was that important to the tribes, why didn't they, you know, do X, or they're taking our tax dollars and yet they want us to protect their sacred site, you know, those types of things. But those are things I expect. But the response has been positive. I'm really happy to be able to perhaps continue this series in the future, expanding it to how the next chapter may very well be how non-recognized tribes are faring. We all know that my tribe is only state acknowledged by the state of California, which means that we now have at least some input into what happens to our sacred places, but of course there's a long way to go. So I'm hoping people have a better understanding.
Well, thank you for that, Deb. And just a big shout out to all the Native journalists out there doing this type of work and, you know, educating the public, but also just, you know, to Native journalists out there in the hustle and the mix. Thanks, Deb. And we're getting close to the end of our show today, and we had a full lineup and callers, and it was, you know, talking about sacred places. Lieutenant Governor, any final thoughts as we end our program today?
Last thoughts. Thank you for that. And as far as education to non-natives, we're always trying to find different avenues, and we're proud to be a part of a production that's going to be coming out in on PBS in November. It's called However Wide the Sky, Places of Power, and that does speak to a lot of our protections of sacred places throughout the Southwest, and that was partnered with a nonprofit called Silver Bullet Productions. And if you also look on YouTube, Zuni in the Grand Canyon, that's a documentary done by our cultural leaders on our migration story and our creation history. So those are some of the things that I'd like to share with share with the audience. And because again, we're looking at these are ways that we have found are effective in not only educating our Zuni people but non-natives. So any information that's contained in these have been vetted and cleared, and so we're proud to share those with you. So be on the lookout for those. And as always, if you look up Pueblo Zuni on Facebook, we try to share the information there as well. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much today, and thank you to all of our guests. Deb Kroll with bringing us this series, and we're bringing it to the airwaves today. Dr. David Martinez, Robert Miller, and of course, you just heard from Lieutenant Governor Carlton Bawakati from Zuni Pueblo. And we have a whole lineup of shows for you next week, topics of discussion on Indigenous issues. And if you want to keep this conversation going online, find us on Facebook, send us a message, or, you know, you could always use email or give us a call. We've reached the end, and thank you to our listeners and callers and all the stations carrying Native America Calling. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. Sol Treviso helped with production. Marino Spencer is our engineer. Nola Daves Moses and Bob Peterson are with Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Trip Krause produced National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief of operations. And president and CEO of Kwanic Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. That wraps up August as a guest host for Native America Calling. I'll be back at National Native News. Find me there. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
This program is made available in part by the Colorado Plateau Foundation, a place-based foundation providing grants supporting Native-led initiatives protecting the lands, waters, and cultures of the Colorado Plateau for generations to come. The Colorado Plateau Foundation helps to build networks, community, and organizational capacity. Information and grant applications available at ColoradoPlateauFoundation.org. Deadline for grant proposal submissions is September 3rd.
Smoking gave me COPD, which makes it harder and harder for me to breathe. I have a tip for you. If your doctor gives you 5 years to live, spend it talking with your grandchildren. Explain to them that your grandpa's not going to be around anymore to share his wisdom and his love. I haven't figured out how to do that yet, and I'm running out of time.
COPD makes it harder and harder to breathe and can cause death. You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.